In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
So welcome to another episode of the In Tech We Trust podcast. It's episode 85. And there is me, Nigel, Mark, and Rick. How is everyone?
Tired.
Great.
Well, why are you tired, Rick?
I just woke up. I'm on UK time. Nigel's a real hero for doing this at 11 p.m. UK time. I couldn't stay up. I had to go to bed about 9:45 and wake up for this. I won't say I'm not jet lagged, but I'm not fully adjusted. And I'm like, well, I don't really have anything I need to do.
Impressed that you've woken up for the podcast, though. It's good.
Hey, man, I wouldn't miss it for the world. I love you guys.
Hey, so you were at Tech Unplugged. I've got to say, Rick, I really liked your presentation today. Why don't you just give us like a quick brief on, you know, what the premise of your presentation was?
How legacy backup isn't enough into real-world challenges today, and talking about, you know, ransomware, offline storage. Is there a use case for that in regards to backups? Different protocols and traversal of authentication so that if there is a propagated threat, how can you mitigate that and all kinds of things like that. But I put a lot of effort into that, Nigel, so I appreciate your comment.
I just thought it was a really good angle that you took, the whole kind of ransomware stuff as well. It's not something that I hear talked about a lot, and how it tends to apply to us and what have you. So, no, I thought it was really cool. So just before we go into tech news and stuff like that, I want to shout out to the listeners that I just finished another trilogy of books, right? And I know I go on about my kind of sci-fi books that I read quite a lot, but I just think that, you know, maybe a bunch of the listeners will find them of interest. So I finished a trilogy called Red Rising. I'm such a disgrace. I don't have my phone in here with me either. Obviously, I listened to them on Audible. I better bang it into Google here because I can't remember who the author is. I reckon they're probably the best trilogy I've ever read. And I think I said that about the last trilogy I read. So I love it, you know, when you go into a new series of books or whatever, or a film or whatever it is, and you're like, oh, it could kind of suck. It'll never be as good as the last series I read, and then it beats the last series. So anyway, Red Rising by Pierce Brown. If you're into your sci-fi stuff, and I don't think this is like massively sci-fi, you know, it's a bit off the wall. It's not something that my wife would be interested in. But if you're into that kind of the kind of books that I talk about here on the podcast, you will love Red Rising. So let's cover the news for the week. In the cloud, and I've scripted this bit right, at the end of a rainbow in a pasture of unicorns. Anyway, Salesforce apparently are planning to host their Internet of Things cloud on Amazon Web Services. Now, I think we did say that the Internet of Things was a unicorn last week, right? We'll see. Docker launches security scanning service for Docker Cloud. AliCloud, Chinese AWS, sees 138% growth. So they're doing something like $468 million worth of revenue now. E8 Storage, a new rack-scale software-defined NVMe storage startup, gets $12 million in a Series B round. And finally, Gartner blesses HCIS, hyper-converged infrastructure systems, saying it's a $2 billion market at the moment and will be probably a $5 billion market by 2019. I thought this one about Salesforce planning to run its Internet of Things cloud on AWS was a really interesting one, because obviously there's some potential competition there. I don't have any experience with what Amazon offers in the Internet of Things space, but I know at least that they're planning stuff. If they don't already have a service for that, they've got like a million services, right? And I can't keep track of them. But it seems to be bucking a bit of a trend as well. You know, these big companies like Salesforce and Dropbox and everybody else, they don't seem to be piling onto Amazon Web Services at the moment. So I'm wondering, you know, why are they doing this time around? Maybe is it, I mean, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts. My main thought was, is it like, are they thinking maybe this IoT thing is a bit of a unicorn? And if so, it's easy to throw stuff up and then tear it down in AWS, right? If you decide that, yeah, it's you know, that's a load of bollocks, that's not going to work. Think maybe they're thinking something like that?
Or maybe they're thinking that we don't want to invest any real money in this, and it's easy
that's
to
what I mean.
Up
yeah.
and can it if we don't need it.
Yeah, well, rather than plowing, you know, another data center hall and load of CapEx purchases and stuff like that for servers.
I mean, that makes sense to me. I mean, I that's the route I would go when I'm testing a new space, especially something as early as Internet of Things for all the hoopla around it and buzz. I mean, it's I just don't see a whole lot of there just yet. Right. I don't deny that it might possibly be a very robust platform and it's leveraged over time. Obviously, as we start to move towards the connected society, we'll have to leverage those types of technologies. It could just be that, you know, it's just way too early to make any kind of bets on any of this stuff, at least in my view. Everybody's gearing up for it, but, you know, it's hard to turn it into like a practical real world example outside of some of like the smart city stuff that they're working on. I really don't want my internet, you know, my toaster connected to the internet and that type of stuff. Those are the silly examples that everybody uses.
Well, that's a legitimate option. We have to first identify what the heck is the Salesforce IoT cloud. I mean, what is that going to do? Is it as advanced as, deep tracking of the metrics of the sales process? And, you know, would it be that the sales team has smart devices in their workspace and stuff latched into smart watches and, you know, audio transcribing and, all kinds of – maybe this person likes sushi, that type of stuff from a sales process. You got to take him to a sushi restaurant. If all of that is going to be in this, it is going to be an incredibly complex app. And honestly, the only practical way to build something that big potentially would be in the hyperpublic cloud. So maybe they're just preparing themselves for a home run. They're sculpting – the scope of this app, because it might not be something that they even want to be in the business of doing. I don't really know enough about Salesforce behind the website. You know, is it really just one big web app? Maybe it is, but if they're going to make something new, maybe they need to do it cloud, you know, native today. Well, and that might be what they're doing.
It's the ultimate SaaS platform, right? Software as a service with an ecosystem of partners and other companies that hook and integrate into it to kind of build upon the functionality. You know, I mean, I've been using Salesforce for a number of years, and it's pretty much displaced pipeline and sales processes for a lot of organizations. It is an unwieldy beast, and I think there are companies that basically make their living on taming it and injecting additional functionality, you know, like hooks into email and things like that, and you know, revenue processes, and there's all kinds of little dashboards and things you can enact and get going. There's like a true art and science behind it and making it work well and having good information and workflow in there, because that's very much a garbage in, garbage out type of platform. It takes a lot of care for you. You know, almost every organization I've ever worked for has had sales operations people that they spend their entire day working on Salesforce. I don't know necessarily how I can relate that to Internet of Things, though. So I don't know if it's a branch that they want to get involved in, but I just don't see how it really matters in the traditional CRM sales process, you know, whether or not, a stoplight has a camera connected to the internet, right? I'm not seeing the tie-in here.
Maybe the toaster will sell you a piece of toast. There we go.
Yeah.
Consumer.
I mean, because I don't look at Salesforce as a consumer platform either. It's a platform for businesses to track and massage leads, generate revenue, and, you know, create pipeline. I mean, at least that's how I live with inside of it.
Sure, but tracking data feeds and things like that from wearables and from smartphones and tablets and stuff like that can lead companies to new sales, push products to certain individuals, things like
that,
right?
Is that really Internet of Things, or is that just an alternate route of consumption for your sales tracking processing data? Like, I mean, I have it on my cell phone. I have it on my computer. I have it on my tablet. And if I have some kind of order entry or processing solution that ties into it, I'm using one of those three mediums to grab it. I'm not necessarily sure. Yeah, like I said, I mean, I'd have to do actual research on it to truly understand what they're trying to accomplish. But on the face of it, it just doesn't seem like it resonates with me.
Okay. Yeah, are they just trying to surf the term? I mean, is Salesforce just trying to, you know, get in the news or something? Or is there really is there something different, right? So I'm thinking maybe they're doing something like Splunk, where they're just getting cash register receipts and all that kind of thing, and they're trying to tie that back in, right? So you've got sales, you've got your CRM type of function that Salesforce is really good at, and what are they, you know, are they trying to add you know, like Splunk type of analysis? And if so, are they just calling that Internet of Things because they don't want to call it Splunk? I mean, I don't understand what relationship they have with Splunk. You know, my guess is it's something like that. They're trying to tie in whatever they can get from point of sales into Salesforce, and they're going to do that in AWS.
But do we think the fact that they're doing it in AWS is a sign that they're not entirely sold on it yet, and that it's something that they could, you know, very easily burn and say, yeah, failed project, let's try something new? You know, that lack.
No, I would. Well, it might be, but I just see it as like, you know, they don't know how scalable this thing needs to be, so why not do it on AWS? I'm not sure why they would announce it. I don't know why that would be a deal that they'd want to talk about. I don't get that. Why do you tell people how you're doing things? I guess
hey,
they get a deal.
They do have an ebook that talks about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What can I do with the IoT cloud? I can connect with everything. I can tackle the haystack and move the needle, and I can engage customers proactively.
I'm sorry, are you quoting from that there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I'm giving that one, I'm giving that one a wide berth.
So that's what it says on their website. Yeah. I'm curious. I'm like, connect the Internet of Things with the Internet of Customers.
Well, why don't you read it, Gabriel, and give us a book review next week?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll be doing that no time soon.
Oh, yeah. So, just on the topic of public cloud and things like that, though, do we think that we're very much getting into the day and age where public cloud services like Azure and Amazon Web Services and SoftLayer and things, like testing grounds, and then as something becomes big and successful, you drag it all in-house then? Is that going to be the norm going forward?
That's how I tend to see it with most of my customers. But then again, I also spend a good amount of time on the tail end of that discussion. How do I bring it all back in once I've got it developed? And that's a very much a pain point. And, you know, I've been having this discussion. I've done three events this week talking about the challenge points around how we pull stuff out of AWS or out of Azure or out of Google once you've got the fully working development model working in those systems. It's very simple to spin something up, get it up and running and off to the races with those services. And that's why they're so successful and so powerful. It's a whole nother thing to get the sign off from the internal teams to run the core line of business applications that aren't naturally a fit for Amazon. It's still up there, right? They still want to bring it back in-house. They still want to control. And what we tend to find is that cost controls, it tends to spiral quickly. I mean, I've talked from customers who spent $3,500 a month on Amazon to ones that spend $3 and $4 million a month on Amazon. And it's certainly top of mind for a lot of people now that the maturity of private cloud has come to the space that it's in, and people now have an alternative that they can kind of leverage themselves.
So this kind of vision of in the future, right, of having workloads that are easily movable across cloud platforms, so from Amazon Web Services to Azure to DigitalOcean to even OpenStack on-premises, right, is that going to be hampered going forward by the fact that these cloud providers – actually, it's not in their interests, is it, to let workloads be portable away from them?
Well, I don't think they're going to have a choice, though. Customers are going to demand it, and then somebody's going to do it, and then somebody else will do it, and they'll follow on and so forth. The cloud companies, the big ones, are the new telcos to a certain extent, and they will be vying for customer affections and attention based on the offerings they have. And people, they will do an arbitrage effort. And they will look at the different clouds that are out there that they can leverage, and they're going to put certain things on each one of those based on the need and the platform and the benefit. And then they're going to want the ability to move those things at will. I mean, that's the beauty of container technology is that I can, right? I mean, at OpenStack Summit Japan, you know, the guys from Lithium demonstrated the movement of an app from on-premises into Amazon and then back down into another, you know, data center location. Seamlessly. And that's the kind of thing that there are certain organizations out there that really want that. It's definitely not capable for a lot of orgs just now, but it's getting there, right? It's this continual evolution of, you know, what we call global data mobility or global workload mobility, any cloud, any platform, whatever. I mean, those are the buzzwords that people are using right now.
So speaking of containers, then that kind of leads us into the next item that we have. Docker this week launched security scanning service for Docker Cloud, right? Which, just the high-level technical side of things, is the ability to You would store your images on Docker Hub, right? And that's got all of your software and your application inside of those images. And they will then scan them for known vulnerabilities. And you then pull those images down and, you know, you tweak them, what have you. It adds new layers. You put them back up to Hub. And because of the way that it hashes all the different layers, it's able to say, oh, well, I've already scanned that layer before. We know what vulnerabilities are in there. You know, security is a hot topic at the moment, and the whole software supply chain of being able to trust the software that we pull down and that we run is really important. But I think the bigger picture here is, you know, we've talked for at least the last year that Docker's got a lot of funding. They've got a lot of mind share out there and what have you. But where's the actual plan to make some money as an organization? And we're really starting to see, if you look at them closely, and obviously I follow them quite closely, I think we're starting to see this kind of growth of their subscription offerings and their paid-for offerings that are starting to include all of this kind of stuff, the kind of things that, dare I say, real companies and enterprises demand. So that, like, core engine, the equivalent of, I suppose, ESXi in the VMware world, not going to make them any money. They obviously grok that. We get that. But like their paid for offerings like Docker Cloud and Docker Data Center for on-premises and stuff like that are really going to start bolting in all of the value add. And I think that's how they're going to hook customers in. Whether it works or not, I don't know. But I, for one, am certainly starting to see at least, I don't know, the early signs of a, you know, potential business model there. Because as much as I've been a fan for it for a very long time, and I really don't want to sound like a shill here, but I think I've been as open as anybody saying, oh, where's that kind of money going to come from? Now I'm starting to see those early signs at least.
Yeah, I think they probably knew early on that the equivalent of a hypervisor was not going to be a business, right? So whatever they did with their basic engine and their most valuable stuff was not going to be recoverable. It's all the services around that. So it does make sense to see that. And security scanning for it should be a really good one. Just the idea of security scanning for Docker in itself, that sounds like serious tech, serious value add for people that are trying to use Docker in commercial applications.
I mean, it's a dead simple idea, right? But it's actually really powerful. I got an early demo of it back end of last week. Now, it's only available in Docker Cloud at the moment, so you'll get it in other products later on, right? But I'm kind of interested to see what kind of can of worms it's opening up here. Are we suddenly going to be looking at the images that we're pulling down and be like, do I really want to pull that down anymore? Because, you know, when you look at your monitoring systems and you look at the logs of the backups from the previous night, it's kind of scary when you see all those red lights and you're like, oh, man, well, I wish I hadn't looked.
But the green can also be the problem. And
totally,
maybe this
yeah.
type of Docker focus on why are these things still being deployed? Maybe it's a deprecated app. You know, if you think about application life cycles, I think these new containerized app frameworks are an outstanding way for people to forget about what's going on in their data services and their IT services. Mm-hmm. So these types of services can be that cloud janitor that we're looking for.
It could be, yeah. I wonder, you know, if you're a shop that's running a lot of Docker stuff right there, I'm not saying that there's an issue here, right? But as soon as you show people that there's a lot of red warning lights on something, it's like, oh, I now have to tell management, and they're all going to start soiling their kegs and be like, well, what are we doing here?
Wait a minute.
What's a keg?
Kegs.
Soiling their kegs?
Kegs are like your underpants, yeah? Your cowies.
Got it.
Oh my God.
No, that's something you put beer in.
Yeah, that's true as well.
I'll never drink beer.
Well, yeah,
beer
I do
that.
Put beer in my underpants occasionally.
We don't soil our beer kegs in the UK, I can guarantee that. But the thing is, right, it's kind of, it's great. But sometimes by showing people things, it's like, oh, you get what I'm saying there, right? Some things are best not told, no?
The keg story was best not told, yes.
I got so distracted by that.
That's all right. I'll tell you what, let's shift on to the next item. I want to know, right, so Ali Cloud, I think they used to be called Alion or Alian or something before. They're the cloud division of Alibaba, is it? I think Alibaba is the Chinese equivalent of Amazon.com. And then AliCloud is the equivalent of Amazon Web Services, right? So they're seeing pretty good growth. I think their revenue was, I've got it written, $468 million, right? Which is, you know, which is up 138%, like I'm saying. But they've been plowing a lot of money into this business. Should I actually trust it and start using it personally? Because I use Microsoft Azure probably two or three times a week and Amazon Web Services every freaking day of the week. Should I have a dabble with AliCloud? But then the second question is, right, they've got two data centers in the States. And I get what they're trying to do there, right? You know, the US is the biggest market. They want to get into it, of course. But there's so much skepticism towards Chinese companies. At least that's my perception, right? I mean, Huawei is a case in point, right? It's not cheap to build data centers in the States. I think they're both like in California, which is not cheap either. Are they barking up the wrong tree here? Tell you what, should I use it first? Should I trust it? Should I start spinning up instances? Keep in mind, right, that I'm not running any production systems, right?
Well, I wouldn't trust a damn thing to Chinese cloud.
You wouldn't.
Of course you should use it.
You're going to copy all your IP, and they're going to stop everything.
Well, I haven't got any IP, so.
Well, not if you go with your own encryption, if you bring your own encryption to the cloud, you know. One of my practical tip there on if you're doing anything with the cloud, make sure you fully control it. I'm in the middle. Okay, so Gabe is hell no, Mark's hell yeah. I'm like, yeah, if it makes sense, go for it. So you got three totally different.
I'm not necessarily hell no. I'm just like, what? I just like, it's trust but verify. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, with the proper security controls, I think you can do anything you want. But the reality is, I mean, if you do business in China and want to have that be an availability zone, then by all means, it makes total sense instead of hosting it here in the U.S.
Okay, so I want to know why Mark was a hell yeah.
Because you just want to be a global guy.
That's right, yeah.
Right? Yeah, let's face it, right? I mean, who knows where that goes? I think, you know, it's an interesting journey. Okay, so they've got a cloud that's outside of China, and you can access it and see what that's about. Why wouldn't you want to do that, Guy? I mean, yeah. You're a football player. Football, as I believe, was the recommended usage that you got.
71% of people at Tech Unplugged today said the beautiful game should be called football and not soccer. Yeah. It was in London, though, right? And I think 29% was Rickatron using every device he had to vote for soccer, right?
Yes, yes. But, you know, actually, you should tell the story. In 2 minutes, you deployed a containerized web app to host this site. I mean, that was pretty cool. Or maybe I pushed create. I don't know what was going on.
Let me tell you, I'll tell you that story real quick, right? So I timed how I could build a 3 data center architecture with 6 networks and 6 virtual machines in Amazon Web Services using a CloudFormation template, so just a JSON file, yeah? And that took, like, after we clicked create, it was 2 minutes, 8 seconds, I think. But then I fired up Docker Cloud to spin up a public-facing web application that was just a simple voting thing. I pinched it from somewhere else, right? And the vote was, should we call it football? Should we call it soccer, right? I got Martin Glasbrough out of the audience and challenged him to eat 5 cookies. So I was going to click create, see whether he could eat 5 cookies before the 5 containers and the web application were spun up. And I'm afraid that Martin, despite his cheating and throwing cookies into the audience to get them to help eat it, couldn't eat the 5 cookies before the, I was going to say 5 container application, I'm going to be hip and call it 5 microservices application, was spun up. So that was a bit of fun. And while we were doing all of that, actually, Rick was my assistant, weren't you? You were clicking buttons and things for me, and I was waving my hands in front of
you. Okay, so that's fair. Martin had assistants eating cookies, and you had assistants on the clicker. So
I stole some cookies. They were really good.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll tell you a quick story as well. The reason that Rick was on the clicker, right, was, he was pressing spacebar on my laptop. I'd tested the clicker earlier in the day and it worked, and I got up to do my presentation and stupidly I took the, you know, like a clicker has a USB like receiver that you plug into your laptop, yeah? So I thought I'd pulled it out of Ian's laptop and put it in mine. I'd only pulled out a USB memory stick and plugged that in. I'm like, the clicker's not working. I'd left the USB clicker receiver in Ian's laptop. Mistakenly thought his USB drive was the other end of the clicker. How embarrassing is it?
So Arjan's laptop was going silently, bing, page down, bing, page down, every time you were trying to click it. And Nigel, it was hilarious because you were holding a clicker still through the presentation, even though you weren't clicking anything.
Never mind.
Oh, that's great. The virtual clicker.
Yeah.
So he would like do it and then you would actually do the operation for him, Rickatron?
Well, I had to do other things like hit refresh and hit create on the, I think those were the micro or the nano apps or whatever that you just described.
But, so did you have to know anything about Docker, Rick, to do this, or did you just were you just like being Nigel's remote clicker monkey?
Well, it was very intuitive because it was – I've done AWS stuff before, so he had prepared it all. But no, this – nothing he did was too complex or more than 26 lines of code.
Guys, you guys are an act. You should go on the road together.
We should go on to like Britain's Got Talent or America's Got Talent and do it, yeah? Do you even have that show over there?
Yeah, all right. We would get voted off the show.
Oh, we would. Yeah, never mind.
You wouldn't admit to watching it or knowing about it.
My kids watch it. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, so
could you be on Our Father Has Talent?
Yeah. Hey, so you didn't answer my second question anyway about Ali Cloud deploying data centers in the US. Is that going to get uptake? I mean, what is the kind of reasoning behind that? Will US customers use it? Because I'd be quite staggered, even over here in the UK, where the UK customers would use it, with it being a Chinese company. I appreciate that's prejudice and all of that, and I'm very far from being an expert on this. Are they going to get uptake on that?
Wow. You know, who's going to do that? Is it going to be Greenfield, new customers, startups? If so, can they really compete cost-wise? But, you know, you look at the overall cloud business, right? And we say that there's no room for anybody else in it, you know, besides the big three. Well, maybe there is. Maybe our assumptions that there are going to be just big three, maybe they look at it and they say, huh, Google? Who cares?
I think certainly in China and over in Asia, they could be, I guess, eventually huge. The biggest, right? And then could eventually be a dark horse, you know, as we potentially come around to saying, oh, you know what, it's not so bad saving our data on their cloud, especially if you bring your own encryption and do everything properly. Maybe, yeah. So could be the big four. That would be interesting. Anyway.
I wonder what Donald Trump thinks of that.
Oh, don't say that.
Never mind. Anyway, so I tell you what, let's switch to slightly more business news. We had two items. E8 storage, rack scale, software-defined NVMe storage startup. I believe they've taken $18 million so far, $12 million in the most recent Series B, and they've only had three investors so far, two of which were Vertex and Accel. Now, I'm not like an expert in the investors' space or anything, but I've heard of both of them at least. They're an Israeli-based company, and again, going back to Tech Unplugged today, Chris Meller from The Register did a piece on the storage space, right? And he did talk about, Rick, did he talk? He talked about an Israeli company that he thought might be a potential winner in the storage space. Did you know, was it these guys or not? Because I can't remember.
It was. He kind of, by the way, Chris Meller presented at Tech Unplugged. That was my favorite track of the day. That was a good. really good track, you know, and he no shortage of character. But anyways, he had summarized about best picks at the end of his presentation, and E8 storage was one of them. In fact, immediately when he said it, I started looking it up on the internet. Yeah, he definitely highlighted them.
Cool. Okay, and Chris is very, very clued up and plugged into that space. So if nothing else, right, E8 storage, they certainly want to watch going forward. Mark, Gabriel, do you have anything, any opinions? You know anything about them?
I mean, yeah, I've read through the press stuff. I mean, $12 million is kind of a small round. Oh, yeah. I'll be curious to see where they're at in terms of what level they're at, right? You do your angel investing, you seed round your angel investing, then you do your A round to kind of get your prototype up and running and operational. B round is either two things. It's A, we need more money to get the runway to get the product out the door, or at least have a minimally viable product. Or it's also, we're going to launch our go-to-market 6 months after this round, after we've gone through and hired a sales team and whatnot. I just haven't had time to look at where they're at right now. I mean, the NVMe technologies are definitely interesting in terms of leveraging it internally, how it connects internal to the boxes themselves. Externally, we're looking at NVMe-based fabrics and what that connectivity looks like, and I still think that that space has a long way to go before it's completely viable. Now, it's an inside-the-box technology.
Oh, right. So maybe I misunderstood this then, because I thought I certainly saw rack scale was in there, which to me suggested there would be NVMe connectivity to anything within that rack. Am I wrong in that, do we think?
I mean, I see rack scale. That's buzzword.
Oh, no, I get that. Yeah.
Excel's done a lot in the storage space.
Excel is definitely a tier one investor. they're definitely first rank. So they've got a top level VC behind them. You say the money, you know, the money's not that big, but if it is software defined, you know, if they're not building hardware, then that's the right amount, I think.
This is a bunch of people who were part of XTB that spun off and decided to do their own thing. So it's yet another Israeli tech startup company with really probably amazing engineering talent. We'll see what they do when it comes to marketing and outreach and how they break into the American market. Because we've seen that a dozen times, and it sometimes ends well and sometimes it doesn't, or it lingers and drags on. I'm an Oreo.
If they don't try to take it to market, if they have a path to selling the technology, that will probably work very well for them.
E8 could use a better website.
Well, they got $12 million. Let's hope that they can hire somebody who didn't work at GeoCities.
And a better name. E8.
Yeah, I was trying to work out what they were meaning by that, you know, whether there was some kind of hidden meaning behind it. I know there was for XIV, and it was like some really esoteric thing from like the Israeli military. Maybe E8 is as well.
XIV was 14. It was the Roman numeral 14. It was the class of people. It was that particular business leadership class. That's the story I'd always heard.
Oh, I thought they were from some like special forces, a bunch of guys from special forces from like Talpiot or something like that.
Yeah.
Never mind. Anyway, so
everybody. Yeah, that sounds like mythology.
Maybe it is. But I got a question for you, right? So in this space, right, so we're hearing NVMe a lot right now. Should we expect to see a bunch of, yet another bunch of storage startups coming and building around NVMe technologies and, you know, internal and external fabrics and things? Or should we expect the existing crop of storage-based, flash-based startups, should I say, adopt NVMe technologies within their current products, next generation products? Or are we going to see that, you know, another wave of startups, it's another technology, a bit like we did with flash, right? Because the existing vendors, they were outdone by the startups, right, in the old flash space.
I mean, it's just another medium.
I know, but so was flash, right?
Well, but flash was so different compared to disk. I mean, orders of magnitude different in terms of performance, characteristics, geometry, all the things that we're looking for, persistence, consistent experience. I mean, there is no, put it this way, there's no solid fire without flash storage because you cannot get predictive performance out of spinning rotational media, right? And that's the whole concept behind QoS, is having a defined set of performance metrics that you can leverage and deal with. And obviously the natural transition of being able to displace massive amounts of, you know, floor tiles with a small form factor to get the same performance metrics. It's not like people bought 1900 hard drives because they had that much capacity.
No.
They bought 1900 hard drives because the performance requirements were way high.
What tends to happen is a number of companies come out at the same time or with similar things, and they make the rounds of the VCs, and the VCs decide to spend money on some number of them. And it's not a conspiracy. It's not anything like that. But usually there's a critical mass of startups, technologies, or whatever that are doing this, which makes the VCs feel comfortable that there's an emerging market or opportunity. And typically where you see one, you see two or three, you know, if not more.